This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is David Lynch. His first film, Eraserhead, was a creepy nightmare about alienation and parenthood that played the midnight movie circuit for years. He went on to direct The Elephant Man, Dune, Blue Velvet, and Wild at Heart. His TV series, Twin Peaks, was perhaps the most offbeat, surrealistic hit in TV history. Now Lynch has a book of photographs called Images, and includes stills from his films, as well as other photographs that catalog his visual obsessions. One chapter, for instance, is called Organic Phenomena. It includes a photo he took in a basement hospital of a cabinet with drawers marked amputated foot, gangrene, kidney, and larynx carcinoma. There's a photograph of a facial sore and another of a decapitated head from his film Eraserhead. I asked him if there were body images or aspects of the body that disturbed him when he was young.
Since we're inside a body, there's a yearning to look at them and know them. And they exist in many shapes and forms, and they have such interesting textures. It's an important place to start this search for the secrets of many things that go together to make up, say, paintings or art.
Would you stare at yourself a lot, stare at your body, also stare in the mirror? And were there things about your own body that you found disturbing?
Well, I wasn't... I wouldn't say I was just hung up on it, but I'm very interested in organic phenomenon, and like I said, it's we find ourselves in these bodies, so they're very interesting, and I think there's a lot to learn, like about proportion and repetition of shapes. Like I say, a painting that works obeys certain rules. And those rules are at work in the way the body is put together as well.
Well, I want to connect this organic phenomena section of your book, Images, to the first movie that was actually theatrically released, Eraserhead, which really is one of the most unappetizing movies ever made, I think. The story is... What's that?
I don't know about that.
The story is about Henry, who gets his girlfriend pregnant, and their baby is this kind of braying creature. And I just want to play the scene where his girlfriend's mother corners Henry to see if he's the father and if he's been having sex with the daughter.
Henry, I asked you if you and Mary had sexual intercourse.
Well, I don't think that's any of your business.
Henry!
Sorry.
You're in very bad trouble if you won't cooperate.
Well, I... Mary?
Mother! Answer me.
I'm too nervous.
There's a baby. It's at the hospital.
Mom!
And you're the father.
But that's impossible. It's only...
Mother, they're still not sure it is a baby.
It's premature, but there's a baby.
Well, I think you were already a father when you made this movie. Was fatherhood disturbing to you?
Yes, it was.
What was disturbing about it?
Well, I was studying to be a painter, and very keen on living the art life. And in the art life, the way I saw it then, you know, it didn't have room for, you know, a family life.
I'm wondering if the idea of a crying infant was almost incomprehensible to you, if you felt so... far away from understanding an infant, if it seemed like a creature or an animal to you?
Well, Eraserhead's about, you know, a couple of different things. And one of the things it's about is a family, but it could also be about other things. So I really love abstractions and things that maybe could be interpreted in different ways. So I don't really like to talk about the meaning so much. It's open for interpretation.
It sure is, and everybody interprets it differently. I mean, I've personally heard so many different interpretations of of Eraserhead. I can understand you wanting to leave it that way.
Now, I think, you know, when you make a film, inside you, I don't always know what I'm doing, and it's a process, you know, from when you start to when you finish. It's becoming something, and you have to always be questioning yourself and finding if it feels right. And it has, on some level, it has to feel correct and honest to the person making the film. But as soon as it's over and people see it, it's like I say, when it's a little bit abstract, everybody has their own interpretation. That's the way it should be. Now people are making films that are so one thing that most people have the same interpretation, and it's not very exciting to me.
It sounds like you must work pretty intuitively.
That's the whole thing.
Well, this whole sense of the body and what's normal and what's abnormal and what's ugly and what's beautiful, I mean, that's not only part of Eraserhead, but it's also in a very different way in the film Elephant Man, which you directed, which is a beautiful film about, you know, the man who had tumors all over his body during Victorian England, and was saved from a freak show by a doctor who was interested in studying his body.
Mm-hmm.
Was this a subject you were already interested in, and when the movie was proposed to you, did it seem like a perfect fit to you?
Yes, I heard the name The Elephant Man, and a physical pop went off in my brain, and I knew I had to make that film. And luckily, I was able to do it.
No, you know, in the Broadway version, because it was originally a Broadway show, the show prided itself on not showing any of the actual tumors on the Elephant Man. It was all done through kind of posture and suggestion. Your film is the opposite. I mean, it quite graphically shows terrible tumors growing from this person's face.
Mm-hmm.
Was that important to you to actually picture it? I mean, at the beginning of the film, he has a shroud over his head, and then that shroud is lifted.
Mm-hmm. It's very important. The whole idea was that you could have someone that was so horrible on the outside, yet his spirit was so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you get to know him, the more the outside disappears, the more the spirit and the shines through. And if you don't start from the reality, there's really nowhere to go. And this person was revealed, you know, in many ways throughout the film. And no matter what he looked like, people fell in love with him. And that's the story. There are other people that look fantastic, and once you get to know them, they're what's shining forth from inside is not so pleasing.
Eraserhead was your first theatrical released movie, and it became a midnight movie classic. Did you know anything about how to market a film? Did you know how to represent yourself to the film industry?
No, I knew nothing about. When I started making films, I knew nothing about film, and after Eraserhead was finished, after 5 years of working on it, I didn't know if anything would ever happen to the film. But Ben Barinholtz, who they call the grandfather of midnight films, he got Eraserhead for his company, Libra Films, and he told me, he said, "David, we're not going to spend one nickel on this picture. We're just going to open it in a theater and let it sit there. And this is a word-of-mouth picture." And he said, "If we hold on long enough, you know, one day the theater will be full." And that's exactly what happened. And those were the times when there were many theaters that had midnight shows, and it was beautiful because these were films that in today's world would, you know, come and go when something's allowed to only, you know, work or fail in 1 week's time. And so you'd see on the marquee Eraserhead year after year, and eventually you'd want to go see it.
What was that point like for you when Eraserhead started to catch on and you started to get offers to do other movies?
I didn't get any offers. I was brought into a couple of meetings at studios, and they were just disastrous. Nobody wanted me to work just from Eraserhead except Mel Brooks for The Elephant Man.
You know, it's always surprising to me that Mel Brooks, who we think of for his comedies, was so interested in having you direct The Elephant Man.
Yeah.
It's almost hard for me to imagine him relating to that pretty avant-garde eeriness and alienation in Eraserhead.
Yeah, I was sweating bullets when Mel was in the screening room looking at Eraserhead. And
he went in just to scout you?
No, he Jonathan Sanger, who was a producer, produced The Elephant Man, told me that everybody, the writers were on, he was on, you know, the thing was going, but Mel wanted to see Eraserhead before he would let me direct the picture. And everything, you know, rode or fell on that screening. So I said, Jonathan, there's no way Mel's going to, you know, like this, go for Eraserhead. And Jonathan said, well, let's just wait and see. So it's a true story. After the screening, Mel literally ran out of the theater and embraced me and said, you're a madman. I love you. So, but Mel is an extremely complex, interesting fellow.
My guest is director David Lynch. He has a new book of photographs called Images. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. David Lynch is my guest. He has a new book of photographs called Images. Now, I want to talk to you about urban landscapes, which is another theme that runs through your new book, Images, and through several of your films.
Right.
In Eraserhead, for instance, there's always something dripping or rumbling in the background. I mean, the whole film is set against this grimy, abandoned urban decay. There seems to be two types of places that interest you most. One is the small, overtly cheerful, all-American town like Lumberton and Blue Velvet or like Twin Peaks. And the other is the decaying, abandoned industrial landscape like in Eraserhead. But even in Blue Velvet, the evil happens in the more urban part of town. You've actually lived in both locations, haven't you?
Right. You know, where you are now, Philadelphia is, I always say that Eraserhead is, you know, my Philadelphia story. And I came from smaller places in the Northwest. You know, I grew up there till I didn't move to the East Coast till I was 15. And when you come from someplace like that and see a place like Philadelphia or, you know, Brooklyn, New York, it has an impact. And it completely fascinated me, and I used to go around in Philadelphia and feel this strangeness, and it was so powerful and fantastic. It really did something to me.
Your interest in industrial settings, mm-hmm. you know, urban decay. I mean, it's so apparent in a couple of your movies, Eraserhead, but also in Elephant Man. Elephant Man is set in the early days of industrialization in England, when there's just like soot and grime all over the city.
Right.
And could you talk a little bit about what kind of effect you wanted the city to have in Elephant Man? What kind of visceral effect you wanted it to have on the viewers?
Well, it was... because it was the Industrial Revolution going on at that time, and because the Elephant Man, you know, looked the way he looked, he was almost like a product of that. And since I'm fascinated with smoke and fire and industry and all the things that happen in factories, it was just an opportunity, you know, at every point I could in the film to, you know, put something like that in. And that Mount St. Helena's eruption, you see close-ups of the eruption, the smoke, the curls of the smoke, or like the curls of the smoke in an atomic bomb, look very much like the growths on the Elephant Man's body. There's some connection of the way a growth grows. It's just a slow motion version of an explosion, sort of. And I was, you know, these textures and the sounds and all these things seemed right for that world that the Elephant Man came from.
Because of those connections that you wanted to get between industry and tumors, did you work closely with the makeup person to create the effect that you were looking for physically in the Elephant Man?
Well, that's a long story, but I was supposed to, you know, do the makeup myself, and I failed very miserably, and it was about the worst time in my life. And Christopher Tucker took over the job and did a beautiful thing. I had made friends with a man named Dr. Nunn, who ran the a little, you know, museum in the back of the London Hospital. And the death cast from the Elephant Man exists there. And after the Elephant Man died, they cast his body and then made a plaster replica of his head and shoulders and one arm and one foot. And Dr. Nunn let the head and shoulders out of the museum and gave it to Christopher Tucker to model the makeup after.
Wow.
That's yeah.
Amazing. No, I have to ask you a couple of questions about Blue Velvet.
Okay.
Was there something in particular that inspired the story?
Not really. I the first two or three ideas were a neighborhood, kind of a green lawns with shadows, like lit at night from a light bulb, and red lips, and the color blue. And the song Blue Velvet, Bobby Vinton's version, influenced it a lot.
I've always wondered how you managed to take a Bobby Vinton record and turn it into a song about sexual fetishism.
Well, it's all in the lyrics there.
You think? Yeah,
oh,
I guess.
Yeah.
Did you hear it that way when you were young?
No. You know, sometimes the timing has to be correct. You hear something for years and nothing happens, and then one day you hear it connected with some other thought that may be happening, and something magical happens.
I just have one other body kind of question for you.
Okay.
And this is about the ear in Blue Velvet. In your film Blue Velvet, the plot is set in motion when Kyle MacLachlan discovers a decapitated ear in the grass. What makes this especially disturbing is not only the ants crawling through the ear, but also that some of the hair is still attached
mm-hmm.
to the ear. Could you talk at all about how that image came to you?
Well, I don't know exactly how it came, but it Jeffrey, the ear is like a canal. It's like an opening, a little egress into another place. And it seemed like a perfect, it's like a ticket to another world that he finds. And, I mean, if he hadn't found it, you know, he would have kept on going home and that would have been the end of it. But The fascination with this, once found, drew him into something that he needed to discover and work through.
What have you been doing since Twin Peaks?
I've been, you know, trying to find my next project, painting, and that's about it.
When you say trying to find your next project, does that require you trying to figure out what you want to do, or do you mean trying to find somebody to finance what you know?
No, I have financing, but I just haven't fallen in love with something yet, and I'm struggling to, you know, to find it. I've written with my friend Bob Engels a comedy that could be my next picture.
Is it unnerving for you to be in a period where you don't know what you want to do next and you're not falling in love with an idea?
Yeah, it's unnerving, but it happens to me all the time. I just don't seem to be able to do one thing after another, like a string of things, like some people are, you know, able to do. I can never seem to... There's always a period in between that I'm struggling to figure out what to do.
So how do you cast about for your next project? Do you sit and think a lot, or wait for it to happen?
Yeah, I sit and think a lot, and I read books, if I find something I like, I have to wait a month or so to make sure it's something I like, and now I'm discovering that I wait 2 weeks and the thing falls away. So in order to work for a year or a year and a half, you really have to be deeply in love with something, and it's difficult to find.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
David Lynch has a new book of photographs called Images. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.